inspired scriptures as the only norm and rule for faith and life was of no effect. The door was shut. The damage was done. The breach was consummated. And it hasn't been healed yet. This peculiar addiction of the Missouri leaders to any disaffected missionary seeking a denominational haven perpetuated itself in the selection of native helpers during the first decade of the Synod's work in South India. The background of more than 70% of the first seminary student body at Nagercoil was a pattern of migration from denomination to denomination and society to society as catechists or evangelists. Now, under such circumstances, let us note how the appeal was framed for support of missions as this appeal reached the home front in America. Here was one sample of writing to Der Lutheraner to Missouri Lutherans in America. Mather asked, "Do you thank God that his word is proclaimed among you in its full truth and purity? What an abomination the ruinous doctrine of false churches and sects were. And just as in the home churches, so also here false doctrine has free course, as it is brought to the heathen. It is lamentable that such doctrine is preached to the heathen. There is so unspeakably much that is false under the cover of truth. But God has been merciful in sending forth his pure word and adulterated word by us. It is a great and wondrous act of God when he allows the Lutheran truth to be proclaimed in its whole truth, even if only in a tiny corner of the land. This is the task God has given our synod in this land. Now, stretch forth your hands and help us without wearying." Now, Mather never said anything like this to the villages of South India he labored among. His diary entries, his letters, and the sermons he wrote can constantly bear witness to the charismatic center of his presentation. In countless instances, which are documentable, he emphasized the law and the gospel and went right down the line of characteristic evangelical missionary motives. The India mission, more clearly than any, illustrates the interesting manner in which varying strands of theological emphasis were forged together into a program which worked, which was successful, which brought results, and finally which issued in a foreign missionary enterprise. The unique story of the foundations of the mission to China in 1913, which center around one of the most lovable oddballs in our whole synodical past, China Arndt. Edward L. Arndt, the account of this man, the account of the mission to Jews, which revolves about one of the least known and the most adventuresome men ever to affiliate with the Missouri Synod, Daniel Lanzmann, the larger theme of mission preaching and mission festivals in the Missouri Synod, these are among a number of additional topics which belong to this subject of the shaping of the missionary idea among Lutherans. But each topic only suggests further illustrations of the basic interpretive idea developed in these pages. Only, that's kind of an arrogant statement, isn't it? But you've got to take your stand somewhere, and this is what I believe. The missionary dimension of Lutheran history in America yields, I believe, a whole new set of heroes. While some of the revered saints of established fame come out with their halos slightly askew. And fourthly, the mission task, in historical perspective, reminds us of how intimately the mission of the church is linked with the unity of the church. In the missionary enterprise, every Christian is in debt to a tradition that is at once wider and deeper than any single denomination. An understanding of that truth about our own missionary task can be a major source for the courage and the faith to enter realistically into the challenge of unity presented us by the present-day mission of the church. Thank you.
Anybody here whose relatives is not looking in himself. now we've got time for what I think should be a provocative and useful discussion. Dr. Rudin, could you come forward here and perhaps be readily available to field the ball and dodge the brickbats as they come? When you come in,
I'm wondering whether the picture might be carried now down to the present or, shall I say, more recent times, to indicate possibly some turning of a corner somewhere, at least hopefully.
That's the goal of historical work. I'm referring to what's been happening in the missionary enterprise of the Missouri Synod, well, let's say, since the end of World War II, up to that time. This includes the Africa thing in the 30s. I think the African enterprise pretty well, in my understanding, fit this peculiar mold of mixed strands. Remember, we began in Africa because of a freelancing native, the Reverend Mr. Ekong, who called our attention to an activity, an opportunity there. But since the close of the Second World War, I think that there have been notable advances in what I would call the priority of the evangelical conception of the missionary enterprise. Japan, as an example. Although I still think that today our problems regarding relationships to the home church and actual practice abroad, this continues. We still live with this problem that many of you men face personally. Is it necessary that the church, let us say, in Korea must transfer all of the issues of the American Lutheran experience abroad before it can find its way creatively in the cause of the gospel? I don't think of another way of stating it, but I think you get what I'm driving at. Is it necessary? Well, is it? Is it necessary that the church abroad, speaking now of our own branch of the church abroad, hold up on every front, from Korea to India, its possibilities, indeed its mandates under the Spirit, hold up until the American situation is, for want of a better term, cleaner? I think that here we see where, again, the scholastic and the evangelical conceptions of the mission and the mission of the church and the church itself, which are inseparable, how these are still operative among us. And I think the lesson of history is clear enough about the irrelevance of transporting lock, stock, and barrel the problems of the home scene abroad. This is not to say that the church abroad doesn't have its earnest theological problems and its struggle to go through. But let it go through on its own terms, in its own way, in its own context. And don't constantly tie it to the home front as if the mission of the church was somehow geographically centered here in America. The mission of the church is just as valid in Tokyo as it is in Clayton, fundamentally. And I think, though, that we've come a long way in really making an effort to outgrow this home-foreign dichotomy. And some of the men present in this room are largely responsible for it, and we all owe a debt of gratitude.
What's their hand here?
I was going to congratulate you on stopping the 1930s review of some of the men who are in the room. But there's
I'm worried about this, huh?
But I wondered, whether you would say that this is a little slanted, possibly. We really didn't get too much of the flavor of a positive situation here. It wasn't all negative, was it?
No, I didn't want it to be. What I wanted to try to say clearly, though, But as I have read the material, this is my results. Now, to be sure, no historian is immaculately conceived. You see, we all wear a certain garment into the past. Nobody jumps out of his skin. And I invite your critique. I want to have your reactions. Yes, sir.
Excuse me, there's a hand way back there.
Right. Yes, as Kramer described it. Yes, that's my understanding. They really came with a vivid sense of mission to the Chippewa. They came in, I think it was the early winter of 1845. Leah had trained these people for something like 2 months. Every week in his parsonage in Neuendechelschau had drilled them in song, in their catechism. A really highly trained group of men and women. In the rare book room at the Harper Library, University of Chicago, is a fascinating letter, original letter, of one young girl who wrote back to Bavaria about her experiences. She was a part of this mission colony. And how thrilled she was when a young Chippewa, about 18 years old, was really engaged in an encounter of witness and what it meant to this girl, a young wife and mother, to be able to bear her Christian testimony to this bona fide non-Christian. That was very large in the minds of this mission colony.
Back there, there was a question against the wall.
I think it's very largely the latter. But what I attempted to channel to you was how they spoke or wrote back to the home front, what motives they collected around, and actually what they did abroad. Now, I see significant strands of different emphasis. I don't mean to indict these men. There is no point in... this is not an effort to painfully blackball anybody, but history is painful. It's painful because it's made by human beings who are sinners as well as under the redemptive sway of God. And it's time we're, I think, outgrowing a certain idealism about our understanding of the past. Now, go ahead. I certainly didn't want to ridicule them, and if that impression was left, it was an unintentional one.
Question here.
I don't know how to say it, but that's a terrible job of the group. You know, many other circles have, and I understand many things now. I'm very thankful to what you brought out. I could never understand our insistence in Germany. Thank you.
we have the idea just because we taught the man the truth, therefore he would carry up the truth. But true finding of knowledge in itself, something like this is stated, is not still making a willing to do it or wanting to do it or getting motivation. And I think we need to do it. I'm very happy that you brought this out because it answers many questions in our own mind.
Any individual attempting a piece of historical work which is more than chronicling who went where when, any individual who tries to get at this difficult, subtle underlayer of why people did what they did, any such individual is, by his very effort, always exposed to generalizations which are over-generalizations, which are oversimplifications. And yet, this is part of the travail of what I think really the historical task is. It is to stick your neck out, because without attempting this effort at interpretive historical work, I think you always miss the real genius of history and its lessons and its meaning for where we are and whither we are tending. And again, I want to impress upon you, I'm not here to either blackball or to whitewash. I'm here to attempt to share with you my understanding of what happened and something of why it happened. Now, an individual who takes a look at my own ministry and work will certainly see many more of the, you don't need any, breastfeeding here, you know what I mean. But let me emphasize this fact. We're not very used to this sort of thing in understanding our past. The only effort that I know of in really a competent, interpretive, historical piece of work is Carl Mundinger's Government and the Missouri Senate. And since that time, there has been a sad drought in getting at our past historically. If you want to give some person a reliable history of the Missouri Synod, what are you going to give him? What will you put in his hand? He's got to be German speaking for that. Well, whoever said host better. Well, he didn't get beyond the Saxon thing in Missouri, Professor Forrester. A history, more than a decade.
Could I perhaps address myself to the query of just a moment ago? Yeah. I recognize fully the sincerity of your inquiry, and I think you deserve all the answers that the essayist gave it, and just this additional comment from an innocent bystander here, namely that I don't believe, as I understood the essayist, that he was attempting to say that you should give people anything less than full obedience to the command, go ye and teach all nations, teaching them to observe all things whatsoever I have commanded you. But if I understood him correctly, what he was criticizing some of ourselves and our ancestors for was the tendency to confuse what Christ commanded with a given cultural way of doing things. And if learning to separate our culture from our Christ, that's what we have to do. So there's no question about ridiculing the heart or soul of that pure doctrine which has been delivered to us. Sam Randall back there with hands up,
Yes, to German Lutheran congregations. I think he kid, he talks about, he describes an average school day at St. Paul's in New Orleans. I knew the dock, apparently. It had some old warehouse. And he describes an average school day. And I think, I'm not in control of these details. I think that he made an effort to teach them a number of chorales. But certainly he did not ask them for German recitation. Yes. Descher, he touched all the buttons on his way south. Mississippi, and he got over into Georgia, into Florida. He made a kind of a missionary tour. And this is a day when many of the plantation owners welcomed any preacher who would come along and begged them to stop and to preach to themselves and to their slave community. And Descher always took on these assignments. Throughout Alabama, Mississippi, Georgia, Florida, he went back to New Orleans where he stayed. Well, maybe I meant both. Again, when Bakke spoke at the golden anniversary of St. Paul's congregation, it was a white congregation, of course, that had begun well before the Missouri Synod was founded in the 1820s or the 30s, this parish had been established and had become affiliated with the Missouri Synod in the 50s or 60s, somewhere along there. Both the white St. Paul's, I guess, and is there still a Negro St. Paul's? I think.
I'm going to call on Brother Brockman here because I think what he has to say related to this.
I see. That's the beginning of the St. Paul's Negro. There's this old sailor's home. Independently from. I see.
I've read another later talk on it, probably it's incorrect. I wonder what you have read it. But I've never heard it mentioned in $3. I've read that he accepted the call to an illustrious which is not St. John, not philosophy.
Now, in 1881, there was quite a lengthy synodical hassle about this, and you can consult the Synodal Berichte of 81. And you'll find a rather lengthy reference to the Descher problem. Oh, yes, after that he did. Yes.
Dr. Hoffman calls for him.
I'm not a historian. I'm not a historian. But I am the grandson, a great grandson, of a man killed by William Gray. First graduate of Fort Wayne, the way of Bangalore to the And I'm also the son of a man who served the congregation founded by President Cruz. He went up to South Indian Mission in Minneapolis. which is what our forefathers thought of, but which you can never quite thought of.
Right.
During their lifetime.
Right.
We were allowed to have playing sites in my home, so my father would never use it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He played books.
Bucket.
Mm-hmm. Well, I wondered, I didn't know this was about the ages of the story. When he wrote to the people telling him the wrong reason for spreading the word,
oh, yes, he did. Very definitely. Very. He did in no uncertain terms. Which was part of, I think, the integrity of the man, which I admire so much in him. No. I really hadn't thought of that there in connection with what I was saying. I must think about it a little while. I happen to serve in a parish which is per square foot a neighborhood, not a kind of a neighborhood, which is per square foot more Masonically populated, I think, than any in the country. And some of the curious things that circulate around about my senior that puzzle me no end. The fact that for 38 plus years he has held the line so stoutly, evangelically, how he has dealt with people in this connection is probably the context out of which I would respond to your question. But I didn't have in mind any direct application to this particular pastoral problem in what I had to say. No, in that connection, let me add this. It's Carl Thorne, really a very gifted man, young man, and a gifted man throughout his life. Carl Thorne, while he was in India, talked about the problem he had in his congregation, members of the church, who kept on insisting that there were three gods, not one. And these were his own members, baptized Christians, that he was dealing with and struggling for and hanging on to. The basic doctrine of the Trinity, you see, how the Spirit has to hammer and build and mold for so long before this it becomes alive and meaningful in the life of an individual who's miles off to begin with. Well, I'm not meaning to draw any conclusions now from the fact that Thorne abided in his own baptized membership people for whom there was not one God but three, because it would be perfectly false and spurious parallel to draw up to therefore say, well, we ought to let large numbers in because that isn't the point at all. But I think that the thing that impresses me so much about the men like Friedrich Lochner, who never went abroad, but who edited the Missionstaube for some years, and who was a splendid example of an evangelical pastor, and Stevers, and some of the others that have been pulled up out of the furrow of the historical work. The thing that impresses me so much about them is that they're really concerned for people. And they had a very clear vision of what is the central burning core of the Christian faith, which is the doctrine of justification by grace, the faith. Well, these men went about dealing with various sundry pastoral problems in many ways. I didn't have in mind, however, any particular allusion to this problem that you've mentioned. Yeah. I'm glad you threw this in. I had every good reason to add this. His trail was no less problematic in his Missouri career as was the case in his Ohio Synod.
While we're at it, we might as well throw in the fact that the reason why he left Missouri, or one of the things that triggered his leaving Missouri and going into Ohio, was that he handed in a memorial about Dr. Walters sending a cable to India to Sutter and Thorne with his praise doctor.
you do money. And then he says to them, often he dealt, and then he sent them $2,500. And Dexter answered the memorial, the canonical convention, said, by what right did Dr. Walters send them $2,500? And this was thought to be unparalleled effrontery on his part. And this was one of the reasons that it gave me the decision to do it. Now let's see, we have Dr. Hilmer up here.
How true that is.
I think that our
we've got another hand here somewhere. No, yes, although I would like to say that our self-understanding as being on a threshold of a breakthrough, I would like to say, represents the continuum of a tradition within our past that has this very clear, I think, and worked at it. I fully agree that the things that Dr. Hillman mentioned are heightening signs of the handiwork of the Spirit among us. None other that I can begin to compare with the importance of this one. I think this is it. Because it really embodies so much. Maybe you ought to say, if we see it that way, you ought to always remember what constitutes the heart of the doctrine of the church. And that's always the center of the New Testament message itself, the justifying love of God in Christ. And, of course, I think that we have so much more to say about the character of denominationalism as a way of life, you see, which is unique in the American scene almost. To be sure, some were Cephas, some were Paul in 1 Corinthians, to be sure, but the peculiar historical circumstances that evolved out of our own national experience are still far from being understood and outlived, I guess, by any single denomination. Oh, I should say so, always and ever. And to always remember that the Spirit of God is many jumps ahead of the structured church in whatever form it takes. And the great miracle and blessing that all of these, he still brings us along with him somewhere. Well, I think the day in which we live is a transition day in the world church scene, isn't it? And so much in now our talk and thought work is not about home to foreign base, but about partnership and obedience, about the planting of the community of the Spirit wherever people gather around the world. Now, it makes a big difference if people, let's say, from Tanganyika, inquire about their connection with the American church from that perspective. It makes a big difference if they're doing it from that perspective than if they are, if they were doing it 75 years ago when there was such a strong sense that really Zion meant America, a home base, or Western Europe. But everywhere in the world today there's this a sense of new beginning, indigenous effort. Tanganyikan Christians ought to be reminded that long, long, long before the gospel ever came to America, it came to Africa. And what it means for them to plow through Augustine, etc., Cyprian, and whatnot. This would be another phase of the same story, wouldn't it? Thank you.
Yes. Yes, I do. I think that this is well stated, and if I grasp your point, I would say it's certainly a valid one. In a sense, this is again at the root of the question of the church, this time asked with reference to its role in the world. And the missionary role, always, whether it be around the corner or around the continent. I would like to draw an illustration here, if I may. There's still time for it. Everybody's not exhausted by all this. But Sidney Lochner, in 1868, in his pastorate there in Springs, Illinois, Trinity Church, this unusually gifted man felt the lack of any sense of connection with the broader missionary happenings in the world at his time. And he knew that the missionary synod could not go to everywhere at every place. And this is what Lochner did. He subscribed to all of the major missionary journals, both abroad and at home. And in the Mission Taube, he channeled into, I guess it was a circulation of 16,000 in a few years. My grandfather out in Nebraska can remember Mission Taube, and many of you and your fathers and grandfathers can too. But here's what Lochner did. He said, "Lochner, you see, reference, he's sympathetic, informed reference to what many other Christians are doing in all parts of the world. And he depended on them not to say that these suggests were sharing falsely under the banner of truth, but to say that Christ is being proclaimed as a working with God." Now, he knew that in setting up a publication of this sort, we were going to get problems from his brethren. So in the first three or four issues of Mr. Young's problems, we got a very interesting essay, editorial, by Dr. himself, and it's 2 points back to 1597 or 1598, and put up Nicolai, Don, Adrian, Tim, Alabic, wrote and in that volume, Nicolai recognizes the basic validity of the worldwide 16th century Roman Catholic movement. Many of the consequences of the same time say, why do you recognize the integrity of this? Because the Our Father, the Ten Commandments, the Apostles, is one part of this message. Not all of the and all of the other things mentioned here, this is true. Therefore, Lochner, in advance, posted a warning against any of his clergy brothers who had been taken on for it. To be declared a rather reliable source, he appealed to his time in store of company. And here's an example, I think, of the kind of integrity that is effectively Lochner's church. Lochner was not blinded by denominational flagrant. He saw that the gospel was being proclaimed in Europe and at home. And he said so in all of the years of his editing and the missionary part. The same thing is, you see, and here's what I want to urge upon you. While Lochner is doing all this, at the same time, in other echelons, in the same Catholic organization, we were cutting off our ties with the life of the Church of India. And you see how both these things exist in the same six bodies. Dr. Hoffman indicated manner, survival is manner, and an evangelical priority is here. It's a kind of integrity that there's a mention on that. I would like to illustrate with this example from Russia. I'm not so sure that all of our missionary reporting today carries the same sympathetic or sad emotional words, but the same awareness that the handiwork of the Spirit is going on in the church today. And here is where I think we're expecting a loan from our forefathers. And I nominate Luckner and Ruth Kim as being some examples of this tradition.
Thank you.
Well, I think that tributary 2 can't be that neatly extricated from 1 and 3, although I probably tried to do it and did so in an hour and 5 minutes worth tonight. But nevertheless, it ought to be added, the point that no single tradition can bear the whole freight of the Spirit's work. What would I say constitutes the contribution of stream 1? I would say here, creative imagination and actually the getting on with the task, because the ground is broken, not by Lutheran. In foreign missions as we understand them today, and that's conditioned altogether by the 19th century idea of the sending emissaries. But we owe to the broader evangelical tradition in England and in America. The actually trying it out and working at it, and my land, the number of graves abroad today of men and women who died in far greater numbers as missionaries than ever they were privileged to see converts gather around them. That's a noble thing and a real contribution. Now, of tributary 3, lest I seem to be an impossible young Turk or something, I think that the vocation that tributary 3 continues to exercise wholesomely in the church abroad today is a concern for doctrinal integrity. And the thing that seems to me to be so important is to get into the arena with the concern, and out of the grandstand, out of the backyard, get into the dialogue, definitely, with this tradition and this concern. You may be sure that if we do not share our light, we shall be consumed by it. So if that's clear enough to you, in a few generalizations, this is what I would say.
I'm afraid we should ask you one more question left, and then I have to deal.
Okay. You know, I'd like to ask you in terms of the practical application of what you're saying, and I appreciate it, and someone could ask you what's the benefit of having this community in the home. But when you say that the existence of a separate conversion of seminary over in the home, and then what illustrates the evangelical thrust of the known field, their concerns over against the need of moving with the existing conditions of the church at home.
Let me cover this while Bill answers now.
Colonel Martin Parker over there, and he knows the people who conduct the other seminar. thinking about
it. I've got an answer, Paul, but, you know.
You like to say what you
especially in theological education, that the divided state of the church hurts most. That's where it hurts most. Why? Because virtually all the seminaries of the city are training operations with 1.5 or 2.5 professors, with 6 or 7 students, or 15 or 20, and 300 or 400 books, or 3 or 4 thousand if you're lucky. So that's what hurts hardest. Just in plain practical terms of getting a respectable education in the world, the educational standards have been moving up constantly in every professional area. And perhaps some of these things happen in Mexico, and on which our Senate Committee on Doctrine and Unity is sending some very serious and major and positive and constructive hours. Look at that. And we have to pray and ask for the guidance of the Holy Spirit. Basically, we were